Okay, today's share is going to be a bit different in that we're not going to focus on one particular parsha or one particular topic, but I thought that it would be worthwhile for us to take a look at the calendar at this time of the year, particularly the way the calendar ends one year and begins the next, and I'll explain that in a moment, and the Arba Parshiot, the four unusual or unique Parshiot that we read at this time of the year to signal the year's end and the year's beginning. When I talk about the year beginning and the year ending, let's understand that there are two major Rosh Hashanah, two major New Years on the Jewish calendar. There are others as well. In fact, it's fascinating, isn't it, that we can't make up our minds about anything, and that we have a series of New Years, a New Year for the trees, a New Year when Maaser began, etc., etc. But the two major New Years on the calendar are, of course, Nisan and Tishrei. The year begins, we know, with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We talk about that all the time. We see that every year. But we should recognize that the year is beginning now as well, in a very different, on a different level. Nisan is referred to in this coming week's unique parsha, in Parsha Sachodesh, as Rishon Hu Lechadshei Hashanah. That Nisan is the first of the months of the year. And therefore, Nisan is the beginning of the year as well. It's a new year's beginning. Now, the fact that we have these two new years is really creates a balance in a lot of different ways. And I just would focus on two of them. Number one, it creates a balance between the poles of Yachid and Tzibur, the individual and the community. Tishrei, in many ways, is the beginning of the new year for the individual. It's the time we say when we recreate in our minds the creation of Adam HaRishon, the creation of the first man, creation of Chava. It's a time when we're speaking about each individual and their particular role within the community and their particular place. Nisan, as a new year, speaks of the birth of the Jewish nation. Speaks of the community, the creation of the Jewish nation. We have to remember, and we've said this numerous times and we'll repeat it, that Jewish history really begins twice. There's a patriarchal era. There's an era that is pre-national. But the national period of the Jewish community, the time when our nation is born, is through Yitziat Mitzrayim and Matan Torah, through the exodus from Egypt, and the receiving of the Torah. Those are the two steps that create Jewish nationhood. And therefore, Nisan and Tishrei create that balance between Yochid and Tzibur on the calendar, and it's a balance that we're always jockeying between in Jewish tradition and in Jewish ritual. Let's understand that those two poles, the individual and the community, can at times be in conflict with each other. If you have full individual freedom, complete individual freedom, then you can't create a community. You can't create a tzibur. Anybody can do whatever they want. There are no rules. There are no guidelines. The famous example given is you can call fire in a crowded theater because you have full individual freedom. You can do whatever you want. On the other hand, too many communal restrictions, too much, and that limits individuality. It limits the ability of the individual to express him or herself. And we're constantly jockeying between those two poles. Consider the way we daven, for example. It's best to daven in a community. And yet, what is the most important tefillah that we have? The Amidah. And that's a personal prayer. When we say that prayer, we're supposed to basically tune everyone else out. We're supposed to say it only loud enough for ourselves to hear. We, at that point, are approaching HaKadosh Baruch Hu individually. But the Amidah is in the plural, right? So even my individual prayers are plural. And then we repeat it again as a community. So we're jockeying between those two poles in everything we do. So that's one balance created by these two New Years. Well, I said, it's best to I started off by saying that it's best to daven in a community. Best to daven in at Tzibur, of course, but then that individual prayer is our own. It's part of the jockeying between communal and individual. The second piece, or the second balance that's created, that I think is created by these two Rosh Hashanah, is the balance between our particular role with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and God's universal reach. Tishrei is universal in scope. Hayom Haras Olam. This is the day of the creation of the world. Tishrei is the new year that speaks for all mankind. Nisan is particularly ours. Nisan speaks about the creation of the Jewish nation. And I think what's important for us to recognize is that when Nisan became a Rosh Hashanah, that could have superseded Tishrei. We could have said, well, this is our Rosh Hashanah, and now Tishrei is no longer Rosh Hashanah for us. But we keep both because we are meant to understand that God relates to all mankind and not just to us. And we're meant to understand our particular role within the tzibur of the world, of the community. And therefore, Tishrei speaks to us even after Nisan is created. And it's extremely important for us to maintain that balance as well. To recognize that while God relates to us individually and uniquely as a nation, his reach extends to all mankind. And we believe in the possibility of moral behavior on the part of everyone, not just Jew, but non-Jew as well. And the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach is proof of that recognition that you don't have to be Jewish to be moral, and you don't have to be Jewish. And those of you who might have read the piece that I had in the Torah Tidbits speaks of that's one of the reasons that we speak to a convert the way we do, to tell them that you don't have to do this. It's not necessary from our perspective. If you really want to, then we go further. So what's happening now on the Jewish calendar, therefore, is we're going from one year to the next on the level of Nisan as a Rosh Hashanah. And it would seem almost to announce that four parshiot, four unique readings are placed on the calendar at this time of the year, and they precede the month of Nisan, almost as if they're heralding that the new year is beginning, and these four parshiot have to be read. They are read as the maftir. They're read as the last part of the text. In other words, we read the regular Torah reading, and then we read it a special maftir. In this case, this Shabbos will have three readings, because it's also, we'll see, it's Rosh Chodesh and Shabbos Shkolim. So we're going to have the regular reading, we'll have Rosh Chodesh, and we'll have Parsha Shkolim. So what are those four readings? Here, I've listed them for you. The first is Shkolim, which we read on the Shabbat before or on Rosh Chodesh Adar. In other words, if Rosh Chodesh comes during the week, it's the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh. If Adar falls on Shabbos, it's that Shabbos. Zohar, which is the parsha, of course, that we read before Purim every year. Para, which we read last week, which is read every year before Parshas HaChodesh, which is the parsha that we'll read this Shabbos, which is always read on Shabbat before or on Rosh Chodesh, as it is this year on Rosh Chodesh. So what are these four parshiot? What do they have to say? Why are they read at this time of the year? And what are some of the lessons that we learn from them? And what are some of the questions that might emerge from them? We'll go step by step. We'll see how much time we have. If we have to, maybe we'll continue next week. We'll see how long our recess is when the siren rings. But we'll take it from there. All right, for anyone who came in late, at 10:45, the siren is going to ring and we have to go downstairs. It's a fire drill. It's part of the Tzeva Adom that's taking place throughout the city today. Or let's start with Parsha Shkolim. Parsha Shkolim is found at the end of Parshas Ki Tisa. And the sukkim before us are not the totality of it, but just set the tone. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe lemor ki tisa esrosh b'nei Yisrael lefkudehem. When you count people, v'nafsnu ish kofer nafsho, a person should give a kofer nafsho, and we'll talk about that term. It seems to mean some sort of atonement payment, something that I'm paying for my soul. And no negef, no disaster, tragedy will befall the people if you count them this way. Everyone has to give a half shekel, etc., etc. So what were these half shkolim? What was happening here? So if you take a look at the why, this is taken from the Aruch HaShulchan, one of the important codifications after the Shulchan Aruch of the halacha.
In remembrance of the half shekel, the uniform contribution to the temple upkeep, announcement of this collection was made every year during Adar. Why? Because the new year was beginning. You were beginning a new cycle of communal sacrifices, and you wanted to collect the money that would pay for those communal sacrifices. So therefore, Parshas Shkalim is read in Adar. Why? Because on Adar Machrizin, or right before the month of Adar, because the Gemara will tell us, Machrizin al HaShkalim. You have to announce for Shkalim, you have to collect the half shekel in the days of the temple so that you will have the money for the upkeep of the rituals. Now, what are some of the lessons that emerge from Parshas Shkalim? And here you see, I listed them on page 2, if it's you're following my page, B, general lessons. The first is to count, you have to do something to count. All right? In other words, you can't just be there. It's not enough. If you want to be counted within the Jewish community, you've got to contribute. And therefore, there had to be this half shekel contribution from each individual. To count, and this, by the way, of course, gives rise, and we'll talk about this at the end of our discussion of Shkalim, to the concept of Ayin Hara about counting people generally. This is one of the origins for that. In other words, how many of we know that you don't count people? You don't go, my mother used to go, not one, not two, not three, not four, right? Or Hoshea es will count for a minion. Hoshea es amecho, urem, erekes nachlasech, urem v'naseh mat olam. You're counting something, and you're counting people in a way that you're not really counting them. Now, but there's a lesson there. The lesson is that in order to be part of the Jewish community, you had to count. Now, again, this was all male participants. There's a whole discussion of why that's so. This has to do with the upkeep, with their communal role. The next thing that's important here is that this was not a... This particular collection was uniform. You had to give a half shekel. Even if you could pay 3 million shkalim, give that to another contribution. This contribution, rich or poor, you gave a half shekel. And the only exception to that that the Chachamim talk about is that if someone is poor and can't even afford a half shekel, you can get together with that person and say, I'll give my half shekel and I'll give a half shekel for you too, and come together, we're coming together, but it's not your half shekel anymore. You're giving it on behalf of that individual. So it's creating a sense of uniformity. It's creating a sense of recognition that every individual within the community has the same status. And I will tell you that this is such, as someone who spent 40 years in the rabbinate, this is such an important principle. I was speaking with someone recently from my congregation, and we were having a discussion, and there were some issues with the community that are going on. And he said to me, I have to tell you, Rabbi, that we always had the feeling that you always treated everyone equally. You didn't, whether they were, and I said to him, that was one of my proudest accomplishments. Thank you for saying that I accomplished that, because I early on learned that I did not want wealth to give someone a stronger say. And this is very hard. All right, someone donates the sanctuary, someone donates the wall, whatever it may be. You know, you want to give them kavod, and that there is a place for that kavod. But rabbinically, you want to treat them the same as you'd be treating the guy who can't afford that. And it's so important, and this is really this concept of a uniform collection when it comes to the shkalim, and everybody is giving the same amount, has a very, very real message to it. Why a half shekel and not a full shekel? So many of the rabbis will say, because as much as we're making you count, because you're contributing, you're not complete. Every one of us is incomplete. Every one of us needs another person to complete us, or the community to complete us. And therefore, in this contribution of the half shekel, you're not giving a full shekel, you're giving a half. And the Torah doesn't say all these lessons. These are lessons that are gleaned by the commentaries and by the rabbis from this contribution. Now, there is, of course, a very real puzzle here. Why is this counting called a kofer nefesh? Literally a ransom for one soul. What am I atoning? What was the nation atoning for when it gave the half shekel? And what would we be atoning for if we were back in that situation, please God, where we would be giving the half shekel? So you have a variety of answers. Answer number one, which is given by the Medrash, is that we are atoning for the sin of the golden calf. Now let's remember, the sin of the golden calf, the Egel HaZahav, is actually, it's a seminal sin. We've spoken about this before. It's a sin which carries with it reverberations that are much larger than the actual event itself. It carries across time. And this was an atonement for that sin. Now, the problem with that is, of course, that in the text, this count is commanded at the beginning of Parshas Ki Tisa, and the sin of the golden calf takes place in the middle of Parshas Ki Tisa. So once again, you have to come back to that principle of Ein Mukdam U'Muchar BaTorah, the possibility that there are times when the Torah is read out of order or is unfolding out of order temporarily. Or you have the principle, which is similar in this case, which is God is giving the refuah before the machala. God's giving the cure before the event occurs. So that's one way of looking at it. Now, it's interesting. David had me research something, and I'm going to make a correction about something that I said a few classes ago when we came up with this whole concept of Ein Mukdam U'Muchar BaTorah. And it's just a small adjustment, actually. I mentioned that the Ramban never accepts that principle. The Ramban basically says everything in the Torah unfolds in order. He does not accept, it doesn't apply the principle of Ein Mukdam U'Muchar BaTorah. The truth is, he agrees that sometimes the Torah is out of order, but only when the Torah tells you that. For example, Pesach Sheni is commanded. The concept of Pesach Sheni is commanded in the text after the unfolding of Pesach, on that second year after the Exodus. So temporally, those events are switched. But the Torah is telling you, the Torah tells you that this occurred earlier. So the Ramban will sometimes accept it, but he accepts it when the text itself indicates it. That's not really applying Ein Mukdam U'Muchar BaTorah. Ein Mukdam U'Muchar BaTorah is applying things being out of order when the Torah doesn't say so, and you have to switch the order. All right, so that's one explanation for the kofer nefesh. It's a kapara for the sin of the golden calf. Rashi and the Chizkuni, among other commentaries, say, well, another possibility is that among the sacrifices that are going to be brought with this machzis hashekel are going to be sin offerings, are going to be karbanot that are going to be brought for transgressions. So in a sense, this is a kofer nefesh. You're giving money which will serve as a kapara for those sin offerings that you're going to be bringing throughout the year. And therefore, that's the kapara. Some commentaries, the Rabbi Nubachyo, Sfarno, basically say, well, maybe the problem is with counting. After all, we said that there's this issue about counting people directly. And they suggest different possibilities. One is that when you count people, you set them aside and you're taking them for that instant out of the community. You're isolating them. One, two, three. And when you isolate people, when they're isolated, that's when they're most vulnerable. We know this from a famous pasuk in Bereishit. When the angel struggles with Yaakov, what does the Torah say? Vayivaser Yaakov levado, vayaveki shimo adalos hashachar. Yaakov was left alone, and the angel suddenly appears, or whatever that we've spoken about, who that might have been, struggles with Yaakov suddenly. When does Yaakov become vulnerable? When he's isolated from the group. And therefore, counting isolates. The Svarno says, well, a census actually is going to have to periodically be taken because why? Some people will be born, but what's going to happen at the other end? Some people, God forbid, unfortunately, will die. And therefore, you're acknowledging man's mortality. And man's mortality is the result of the original sin. We don't believe in original sin in that, in those terms that, that Christians believe, but it's, we believe that it has an effect on us, not that we're guilty of it. And therefore, because of Adam and Chava's sin in Gan Eden, mortality is created. And therefore, the fact that we are mortal is being underscored by this count. Rav Moshe Chayfetz says that it's a kofar nefesh, and this is a beautiful thought. It's very, very practical. This is a kofar nefesh because the way it's being done avoids sin. The way it's being done avoids what? Avoids envy, avoids greed, avoids the differences between us. But there's another possibility. And this other possibility occurred to me many years ago. I thought about the use of the word kofar in the Torah. And kofar in the Torah actually is used to speak about a payment for a specific kind of sin. First of all, the Torah says you can't accept kofar for certain sins. And it goes out of its way to say it. You can't accept a ransom for a sin of commission. When somebody kills, when somebody steals, they can't pay it off. They can't basically say, I'm paying it off. Even if someone injures, what does the Torah say? That ayin tachas ayin, eye for an eye. Now that will be translated into monetary, but there the Torah is saying on a level of real guilt, it's not a monetary crime. It's just that we don't poke out people's eyes, God forbid, to punish them. So the Torah goes out of its way to say ayin tachas ayin. It doesn't say it's monetary. It says it's nefashot. It's in the realm of non-monetary crimes, but we'll pay it monetarily. But there's one particular time when the Torah says a person deserves death, but he can pay it off. And what's that case? I brought that case for you. It's a case of a shor nagoch, an ox that gores and kills someone. So the Torah says that if the ox that gored is a tam, in other words, it's a regular ox, it hasn't shown itself to be dangerous, then there's a certain amount of payment that you have to give because you didn't expect, it's unusual, it's not normative for an ox to gore someone, so you can't expect that to happen. But if the shor is muad, if it's proven itself to be a dangerous animal, gored three times, it established a chazakah, and you failed to watch it properly, and it kills someone, what does the Torah say? V'im shor nagachu mitmol shel shom, v'huad bevalav, if this has shown itself to be a dangerous animal and it was testified as such to the owners, v'lo yishmerenu, and the owners don't guard it properly, v'hemis yisho yisho, hashor yisakel v'gam ba'alav yumas. The animal should be put to death and the owner should be put to death as well. But then the Torah continues. Im kofer yushas alav. And literally it seems to be saying, if the man wants to pay off the debt, then we will come up with a way to determine what the payment should be. But the rabbis explain that that's not a choice. Even the Torah seems to couch it as a choice. Basically, the law is that if your dangerous ox gored someone, even though on some level in the heavens you are guilty of death, you pay a ransom. You pay off that guilt. And what's the Torah saying? Well, this was a sin of what? This wasn't a sin of involvement. This was a sin of uninvolvement. This was a sin where I failed to do something properly, where I didn't involve myself. So what the Torah is saying is, in a sin of uninvolvement, even though the person deserves death, what do? You'll have him pay it off. So it occurred to me, just possible, that the kofar nefesh here is for, in the case of shkalim, when I'm giving a communal contribution, is I'm paying off for all the times that I wasn't involved in the community enough. I'm paying off all my sins of uninvolvement. In other words, I'm giving kofar and I'm acknowledging that this is where I belong. I belong in the community. I belong as part of the community. And therefore, I'm paying a kofer nefesh for not being involved enough. It's a possibility. It's a possibility. It occurred to me many years ago. All right, now let's take a little bit of a segue here, and let's discuss something else, which emerges, as I said, from this concept of shkalim, which is the concept of what we call an ayin hara, right? Why do we say, why? We shouldn't count people because you're going to create an ayin hara. This concept of ayin hara really smacks of superstition, the way it's understood, right? Isn't it? Ayin hara, the evil eye, I wear a red bendel, I escape it. But if you look at the sources of ayin hara in halacha, ayin hara comes when I act in a way that is ostentatious and create jealousy among others. And the ayin hara is the way that people look at me and are jealous of me. So in other words, for example, you're not supposed to give two brothers an aliyah, or a father and son, and two aliyahs, one back to back, right? In other words, if there's a bar mitzvah, you'll notice that they'll go out of their way. They won't give a father and a son or two brothers. There's always someone in between them. Why not? Because you don't want to have an ayin hara. What's the ayin hara? Well, who thinks who they are? Look, they're getting two aliyahs, one back to back. You're creating an ostentatious situation. You're creating a situation where jealousy will be bred. Now, let's understand. The person shouldn't be jealous. It's wrong to be jealous. But like so many other laws of this type, we recognize human nature. Let's take the case of Maris Ayin, for example, which is different than Ayin Hara. What's Maris Ayin? Maris Ayin is, I shouldn't act in a way that will lead you to error. I shouldn't walk into McDonald's in America to get a cup of water. Why? Because someone seeing me walk into McDonald's will think one of two things. Either I eat treif, or that's a kosher McDonald's. Right? In other words, I shouldn't create a situation. I shouldn't go to the store and buy a ham for my non-Jewish neighbor and put it in my cart if people are going to assume that I'm buying for myself. They shouldn't be looking in my cart. They should, right? They shouldn't be, they shouldn't, why should someone assume if they see me walking into McDonald's that I'm going, they should say I'm going for a cup of water. But no, they shouldn't do it, but they will, right? So because of that, I should not act in a way that will cause them to do it. So if we understand ayin hara, and I included here, with your permission, a section that was written in one of my books about ayin hara. And if you take a look at the last paragraph on the page, the ultimate purpose of Jewish ritual is to shape the way we think and act. The ethical lessons embedded even in the most esoteric of our traditions should therefore not be ignored. To avoid an ayin hara, we must not only superstitiously seek ways to escape its wrath, we must refrain from the moral behavior which gives rise to an ayin hara. That's the key. In other words, we should, and if you take a look at the next page, the last paragraph, conspicuous consumption, the flaunting of material wealth, the desire for others to beware and covet our successes are all phenomena prevalent on our day, are antithetical to Jewish thought and to our overall spiritual health. That's the real lesson of ayin hara. So when we talk about ayin hara, what I would suggest we do is not just think about it superstition, but recognize that what we're saying is don't create a situation where someone will wish you ill, where someone will be jealous. Yes? Excellent. Very good. Excellent. Okay, so I'm going to, for the people that are zooming in, if you still stayed with us after the recess, So the point being that this ties into the theme of my responsibility for the community, which we said is really the theme of Shkalim. And that moves into my responsibility to avoid behaving in a way that will lead others to sin. Yes, someone had a hand up. Yes. Amen. All right. Being repeated, her mother said, don't do anything that will cause you to fall into someone's mouth. That's really, don't create an ayin hara. What's don't create an ayin hara? Don't act in a situation where people will look upon you or speak of you or see you in a particular way. Yes. Okay. All right. So this is very good. All right. So this does bring up, as was being said, the issue of major donors and open appeals and things of that kind. Now, I have to tell you, as a rabbi, I very much wanted our shul to conduct closed appeals. I didn't want there to be open appeals. We tried it once. We got half the amount of money. All right. So there has to be a balance between, and you're right, it does create that kind of, but it does encourage others to step up. So there is a balance, and maybe the rabbi has to get up and say, listen, we're doing this because we have to. We'd rather not. And the point is, don't be jealous. Do what you can. Do if one person giving $5 is equivalent to a person giving $1,000, if that's what you can give. And you have to go out of your way to say it. That's right. And we also teach that you should always judge someone favorably. That's why I said you shouldn't think these evil things about people. You shouldn't be jealous. But the fact is that halacha recognizes human nature and says, I shouldn't act in a way that's going to cause others to fail. All right, we'll hold any other comments now and move on, and then we'll take comments at the end of the class. I again got a request from someone on Zoom to limit the discussions till the end. Okay, so here we are, next. So we go to the next of the two parshiot. We're moving from Shkalim to Zachor. Moving from Shkalim to Zachor, we move to a whole different realm. We're here from the realm of a community that is good and whole and a community that I want to associate with. We move in Parshas Zachor to a community that I want to eradicate, to a world that I want to destroy. And let's take a look at what the Torah says. Zachor es asher asah lecha Amalek b'derech betzeischem mitzrayim. Remember what it is that Amalek did to you on your way out of Egypt. Asher karcha baderech, they have, now that word karcha is very interesting. Karcha is, on a pashut pshat level, it means they happened upon you, and I'll come back to that. There is a medrash that says that it comes from the word kar. This is not pashut pshat, this isn't the actual interpretation of the text, but it's a nice lesson. Kar means cold, and what this medrashic interpretation says is that when you came out of Egypt, you were so hot, nobody would touch you. Once Amalek started, though, others felt the ability to do it. They cooled you down. So in other words, they were the first ones to attack, and therefore they opened the door for your vulnerability to attack. All right? And what do they do? Who did they attack? This is what we're seeing today, unfortunately, in the Ukraine. Who are they attacking? The weak, those who can't defend themselves. Amalek hit the back of the line. They didn't come at you as an army willing to confront your arms. They're coming and they're picking off the people in the rear. And that's, you know, when you see someone bombing cities and bombing civilians and attacking in that way, that's an Amalekite way of behavior. But when God will give you the opportunity to establish yourselves in your land, and you all the other enemies misaviv, you will quiet down enemies misaviv. Timche et zecher Amalek, you should erase, you should eradicate the memory of Amalek mitachas or shamayim lo tishkach. All right, and let's first go with the technicality. Why do we read this before Purim? We read this before Purim because of the tradition that what? That who? That Haman is an Amalekite. In fact, the Megillah refers to Haman Ha'agogi. Agog was the king of Amalek that Shaul spared, and therefore Haman comes as a direct descendant of that king. But interestingly enough, the Aruch HaShulchan also quotes a pasuk in the Megillah, and I hadn't known this before. The pasuk in the Megillah says, "Had yomim ha'elu nizkarim v'naasim." These days are remembered and done. So the play on that sentence is, "You remember before you do," and therefore here we have the remembrance of Amalek before we talk about eradication. Now, Rav Soloveitchik and others speak about two different kinds of Amalek. One is the Amalek who is an actual descendant of that nation. And the fact is that we don't know who that is anymore. The rabbis have a principle. It's a very interesting historical principle. And that principle is that when Sanherib, the Assyrian king, conquered his known world, and among his conquests was the kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes, what he did was he specifically, this was the Assyrian methodology of subjugating the conquests, he mixed people up. He took people from their land and put them in other lands. He took people from other lands and replaced the inhabitants. In this way, they wouldn't be able to, then he spread them throughout. This is why the 10 tribes are lost. As opposed to the kingdom of Judah, which was exiled to Babylon, and the Babylonians allowed us to create communal constructs, allowed us to have our own communities, and the Babylonian community thrived. The Assyrian king didn't allow such communities to take place by spreading people throughout his kingdom. The rabbis therefore say that from the time of Sanherib, we can't recognize, we can't identify original natives. We can't say, I know that this person is an original Mitzri, is an original descendant of the Mitzrim. I can't identify an original Amalekite either, because an Amalek basically is interspersed and lost throughout the world. But what can I identify? I can identify a spiritual Amalek. I can identify an individual who is an Amalekite not because of biology, but because of activity, because of who that person is. And the Rav Zatzal, Rav Soloveitchik, in those days spoke about the terrorists that he knew of. We can speak of other people today in our world that are acting in Amalekite ways. And that has to be eradicated. That's an anathema to us. Those individuals are those people who are identified by their behaviorally, that's a better way to put it, as Amalekites, have to be eradicated because you can't coexist with them. And this comes down to Amalek was a descendant of Esau. And we have the principle when Esav and Yaakov are struggling in Rivka's womb, it says, "Ulom milom ye'amatz." One will be strong and one will be weak. And the rabbis say, from this you learn, it's a very powerful statement, that from this you learn that if someone tells you Caesarea and Jerusalem are both standing, don't believe them. If someone tells you Caesarea and Jerusalem are both destroyed, don't believe them. Believe them if, God forbid, someone says Caesarea stands and Jerusalem has fallen, or vice versa, please God, Jerusalem stands and Caesarea has fallen. They can't coexist. You cannot live in an Amalekite world and continue to have real morality if you allow it to occur. We said that Achashverosh was guilty of allowing, creating a world in which Haman could thrive. So therefore, the commandment is you have to destroy Amalek. Now, what is Amalekite behavior? So the Torah tells us, Asher karcha baderech. When the hatred exists independent of any particular cause, that's Amalekite. When the hatred, what happened with Amalek? They happened upon you on the way. You weren't traversing their territory. You weren't endangering their food supply. You weren't drinking their water. You were doing nothing to warrant this attack. That's Amalek. And Haman fits the bill, because as we said when we learned before Purim, Haman fits the bill because what happens? Haman is threatened by one individual. In his mind, he's threatened by Mordechai. And what does he conclude? I'm going to what? Not just kill Mordechai. That a normal, horrible person would do. But an Amalekite says, I'm going to kill everybody. I'm going to kill all the Jews just because I have a problem with Mordechai. So the hatred that exists that we see springing up throughout the world again, this anti-Semitism, this is Amalekite. This is what we feel is Amalek. And any hatred that exists against any people, not just us, when someone is attacking in that way. Now there is, it would seem, however, a fundamental contradiction in what the Torah is telling us to do. The Torah says, Zochar es asher asa lecha Amalek. Remember what Amalek did to you until you get to the point where what? Timche et zecher Amalek, when you eradicate the memory of Amalek mitachas hashamayim. So on the one hand, I'm being told to remember. On the other hand, I'm being told to, yeah, so what's the, what? Okay, we're being told to remember his behavior, but to wipe out the memory of his existence. That's very good, and that's one way of looking at it. I would see it a little bit differently. There's a difference between eradicating and forgetting, right? If I forget something, what's going to happen? It's still there. If I forget something, then I am perpetuating it by definition, because I'm not acknowledging its existence. L'havdil elef havdalos, if I have to make a very difficult phone call and I keep forgetting to make it, right? I haven't taken care of the problem, right? The problem's still there. I have to make that phone call. If Amalek exists and I forget what they did or I forget their existence, what am I doing? I'm perpetuating the existence. It's not just that I'm not parav. I'm actually perpetuating their existence because forgetting it allows it to thrive. What is the commandment? The commandment is to eradicate the memory, right? To obliterate the memory. Create a world in which Amalek is no longer remembered because you've destroyed the existence of that behavior. That behavior no longer exists, and therefore you're not forgetting anymore. It's not an issue of shkicha. It's an issue of mechika. I am erasing. And therefore the Torah simply says, and it's very important, the Torah says, if you read the Parsha, going back to the actual text, Timche et zecher Amalek mitachas shamayim, lo tishkach, erase, don't forget. And what the Torah is actually saying is that's the distinction. That's what the Torah wants you to do. Take care of the problem. And, you know, this is really what we say when we turn to people who, how many times have we heard from an outside world, why do you Jews keep harping on the Holocaust? Why do you keep remembering? Why do you keep talking about it? It's past. It's going to be how many years already? So why do you keep bringing it up? And the answer is, we keep bringing it up because we're afraid it can happen again. We keep bringing it up because when you forget something like this, that's when it springs up. And therefore, Parshas Parah becomes the second of the parshiot that we read. Now, Parshas Parah is different than Shkalim and different than the other two, with the exception maybe of Parah, we'll talk about next time, Parshas Zohar, according to the commentaries, is a biblical mitzvah. When we read Parshas Amalek, we are fulfilling the mitzvah of Zohar es asher asolecha Amalek. Torah reading in general on Shabbos is not a biblical mitzvah. Torah reading in general on Shabbos or Yontif is a rabbinic takana of Moshe Rabbeinu, actually, that we should have Torah study on a regular basis, and therefore we put Torah study into our davening on Mondays and Thursdays. You shouldn't go 3 days without studying Torah. Now, hopefully that's not the only Torah study we do, but it's ensuring Torah study. When you get to Parshas Amalek, and that's why people go out of their way to say, you have to be there, you have to hear it, this is a biblical mitzvah. This is we're fulfilling the mitzvah of remembering what Amalek did to us. And the Torah says, lo tishkach, means that emphasis means you should do it verbally. And that's what we're doing when we're reading Parshas Amalek. So to sum up, we've done two of the parshiot. I wasn't sure how far we'd get. We've done two of the four parshiot that we wanted to cover. And we'll Be'ezras Hashem take a look at the next two parshiot. One which is Parah, which we'll be able to deal with quickly because we dealt with Chukim and Tumah and Taharah last week. And then we'll get to Parshas HaChodesh, which will be an interesting way to segue into the Pesach season, to talk about the Seder a bit. And there'll be information for you about how to deal with the Seder, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll focus on that next week. Understand that the week before Pesach, I've told them I'm going to be unable to have the class. So it's next week will be our last class before Pesach, and that's why I'll be focusing on Pesach themes. But just as a comment, and this is totally obviously up to you, I had this chus to produce a Haggadah among the volumes that I've produced. If anyone wants a copy, I can make it available to you. It's $25 or 80 shkolim for a text. If anybody wants it, just let me know today so that I'll bring some copies next week. But no obligation whatsoever. Just wanted to let you know it's available to you. Okay, thank you very much, everybody, and we'll see you, Be'ezras Hashem, next week.